Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Joining us on the line now is Anne O'Dowd, who recently retired as curator at the National Museum of Ireland, where she was curator for more than 30 years. Her book, Straw, Hay and Rushes in Irish Folk Tradition, is about the humble materials of straw, hay and rushes, and that they were utilised throughout the centuries in Ireland for a myriad of uses. The heyday of their use as objects were the 18th and 19th centuries. Welcome to the show, Anne.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Thanks for joining us. So what was it like being a curator at the National Museum of Ireland for more than 30 years? What a job.
It was wonderful. I loved it. I think apart from, you know, the usual work structure type thing, I felt for 30 odd years that I didn't work a day in my life. I loved the work. It gave me an opportunity to travel around the country and meeting people, and it was, I have to say it was wonderful.
Oh, fantastic. And where's the museum based?
Well, for most of the time I was working, it was in Dublin City, the National Museum in Kildare Street, but the particular collection that I looked after, the Folklife collection, was eventually moved to a site on the west of Ireland, in County Mayo, and that's where it has been for the last 21 years.
Okay, wonderful. So tell us more about this Folklife collection then.
It's the collection that didn't really get much attention. Now, that's not a bad thing. I worked as a curator. There were one or two others as well. But for most of those years that I worked, I worked fairly much as a lone curator. And what the collection is about is looking at how we lived in the last 200 years or so. You can never kind of be specific of how old the tradition of using something is, as distinct from the actual object itself. And that comes out very clearly in a lot of the objects made from straw and hay and rushes. It's pretty much, that collection is pretty much the core of the folk life collection, as we call it. The other things that people would be familiar with from you know, their own memories, if they're old enough, or from visiting museums, would be things like all the kitchen furniture, the kitchen dresser, the table, the chairs and that, the beds, but also the farm machinery, you know, the hand tools, the spades, the slains for cutting the turf, the flails for threshing corn. Anything that was pre-industrial, very much in inverted commas, anything that people made themselves mostly at home in order to do the work that needs to be done in the house and around the home.
Mm. I say with your job and your time with the museum, you were learning something new every day, were you?
Without a doubt. I suppose one of the people that I had a lot of regard for was a former director of the museum, a man called Dr. Lucas, and he would have told me in my very young early days in the museum that it would be a funny day that would pass at work where I wouldn't learn something. And it wasn't learning from books necessarily, if you understand me, because the people that I would have met around the country in my travels collecting objects for this collection, they were the ones who knew about it, not me. They were the ones who were able to tell me about how objects were made, how objects were used, when they were last used, how long they had been in their possession, and all of that. So I couldn't go and say, "Oh, I know all about this." My job was to listen and hear the stories about the objects. and to hear the individual connectedness to the families of the people who are either selling us the objects or donating them. So yeah, definitely I got a great education. I obviously loved learning what I was learning as well.
It must have been fascinating meeting all these people and hearing those family stories of these objects being passed down through the generations. I'm guessing with some of them maybe they didn't really know much about it. Was that the situation as well sometimes?
I'm not so sure of how widespread that might have been. I think they didn't understand. I think they didn't have an awareness, I suppose would be a better word, of how important they were to me as a museum curator, if you like. And maybe they thought I was a bit daft, or the whole collecting thing and putting things into a store somewhere in Dublin, as it was at the time, was a bit strange. But they did appreciate, the notion of somebody remembering how their lives had been lived, because they were quite close to a subsistence level of living. Perhaps in countries like maybe Spain or Greece, it was similar. And still in agricultural communities, which Ireland very much was into the 50s and 60s. Because you have to remember, the tractor, for example, which was the one thing that probably changed rural living in Ireland more than any other piece of equipment, was only becoming widespread in Ireland in the 50s, 60s. So there was that rapid change from using hand tools to suddenly having this big machine, as it was then. So I think there was very much, for the much older people than I was at the time, an appreciation of somebody not ignoring how they had lived their lives. Let's put it that way, I think, is the way I would remember it.
Yeah. And how is it decided how much these items are worth? I know you said some people donate them to the museum and some people would sell them.
That depended on the individuals very much. So, for example, if there was an exhibition in the museum and got a bit of publicity in the papers mostly at the time, people would then write to the museum and say, oh, I've got this, how much is it worth? So the financial aspect of the objects, it really only became an issue in the last 30 years or so. Mostly, not always, people would donate objects.
Yeah.
With this vast collection of objects made in Strahe in Russia, most of those objects were donated, made for the museum, and then donated to the museum. Then in times after that, You had to do a bit of negotiation and be a bit smart, I guess. There were no antique dealers at the time putting a value on these things, in a way, fortunately, because the prices would have shot up if they had been, and they have arrived on the scene in the last 20 years or so. But at that time, it was giving, a few shillings, 2 and 6 pence. 5 shillings, 6 and 6 pence, that type of money for a lot of the objects. So the museum would have had that kind of money, even though it wasn't very well financed in those years, but it would have had that type of budget to help collect and add to the collections.
And as I said in the introduction, the heyday of the use of these objects were the 18th and 19th centuries, when travellers to Ireland were often writing disparaging and derogatory accounts of what they saw. Why was that?
A lot of them, unfortunately. The great era of travel writers, men and women, predominantly men, but a lot of women as well. There were a lot of English people. Now, there were French and German as well, but it has to be said, there were a lot of English people coming to Ireland in the beginning of the 1800s, then right through those kind of, very poor years in the 1830s, the famine 1840s, and then the recovery in the second half of the 19th century. But they had come from very, very comfortable backgrounds. They had beds to sleep in and sheets and pillows, and they were looking with their eye at people living in bare subsistence economies. So they would have seen it as people living in very poor circumstances indeed, and wondering why they weren't improving their circumstances. But the word poverty would have come up a great deal in these accounts, and that, of course, is a relative term. People didn't necessarily spend money on comfort objects for their houses, because the important thing was the stock, especially the cattle. And any money that was made went to the care of their animals rather than necessarily adding to their own physical comfort.
Interesting.
You see, that's where the objects made from straw and hay and rushes comes into its own, because they had that raw material in the vicinity, in the landscape around them. So they learned how to utilize that into making things like mattresses to lie on or chairs to sit on, and even for protection for themselves, to make capes for protection against the cold, for protection against the wind and the rain. So they were able to have comforts without necessarily having to have money to spend on those comforts.
So they had easy access to the straw, hay and rushes, so yes, hence why it was being used for a lot of things.
Yes, that's exactly it. And then kind of associated with it was the importance of straw in terms of not just being protective in terms of keeping people warm and keeping people dry, but straw is believed to have kind of a curing or a protective quality in terms of being something that would help keep you safe if you were out at night time. Straws placed under the mattress, for example, of a newly married couple has to do with fertility. And the new mother-in-law might place some straw under the mattress of the newly married couple to help them along with starting their family. And then, of course, newly married couples, when they were coming home from the church, having been married and coming home to the house, people lighted straw along their way. This was something that was done in other European countries also, of course, and it was to bring luck to the newlyweds. But it was really not so much luck to the individual couple, but to ensure that there was fertility within the marriage.
Yeah, ensuring that the straw was under the mattress and not on top of it, otherwise it would have been very itchy.
That's it. But then, of course, the mattresses were made from straw.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So they'd put a cover, a cotton or a ticking cover on top of that. But they made mattresses of straw. Wow. I think the most intriguing objects made of straw were hen's nests. These were, on average, about 2.5-3 feet high and 2.5 feet wide. They were like a beehive with a wider opening for the hen to jump into and lay and hatch her eggs. The hen was very important in Irish folklore, probably introduced in Roman times, but became a very important part of the diet, both the eggs and the meat from the hens around the time of the Vikings. So the hens were greatly protected. And it's very important, I suppose, from a women's folklore, women's history point of view, the women looked after the care of the hens. So whatever monetary profit was made, it was theirs to spend. And they kept that going until well into the 20th century.
Wonder if there's anything associated with the phrase mother hen.
Yes, oh, absolutely. It's all about. And the clocking of the hen and all the very strong folklore about when you put down a clutch of eggs and the ebbing and flowing of the tide, how to know when an egg was fertilized with a male or a female hen, and or male or female fowl, and if a hen, for example, walked into a house with a straw on one part of its body, it meant luck. For example, if it was on its foot, it might have meant, oh yes, this is going to be lucky. Or if a hen walked into the house and had straw on its back, it meant, oh no, something terrible is going to happen. So this was what the women observed, because they were, of course, closely associated with the work around the house and in the house. Yeah. So they were able to observe all of these things. But the respect of the hen was paramount within the house, keeping the hen happy, because the very strong thing in Irish folklore is that hens are believed to have come from Denmark or the Danes. That means any northern group in Irish folklore. So it could have been the Swedes or the Norwegians who introduced hens to Ireland. Probably a reference to the Vikings more than anything else. But the hens are believed never to be happy. They're always giving out and they always want to return home. Mm. So the woman of the house would always say, we have to keep them happy. But the hens' nests are beautiful constructions. They're absolutely, these days you'd look at them and see them as an artistic sculptural piece of straw, you know, which is, it's wonderful that we have such a nice collection of them within the National Collections in Ireland.
Yeah. And obviously with the huge invent of other materials since the 18th and obviously the 19th century, are all of these objects that you have in the museum, would they all be made out of other materials now, or are there any kind of traditional Irish companies that would still be making things out of straw?
No, and I was talking to somebody about this recently when I mentioned to this interview to them, and I think it's a esparto grass that they use a lot in Spain, and you see that a lot along the souvenir shops and that, and also in countries like Greece and France, where the traditional objects made, now the really traditional objects, the ones that were made by people who use these objects within their living circumstances, we haven't really taken that on board yet in Ireland. But I do think that when people see the beauty of them, that they realize, yes, people would actually buy these if they were made. Now, they make things like St. Bridget's crosses, which are very easy to make. Every school child in Ireland makes them on the day before St. Bridget's Day, which is on the 1st of February. Mm-hmm. And then a very English tradition, not a particularly Irish tradition, but which has taken off in Ireland in the last 10 years or so, is the making of harvest knots, again, from straw. But it's the bigger objects that I think could easily be made into, you know, an artistic manufacturing boutique style interior. The only problem is, though, is the availability of straw. That's always been an issue, as to where do you get the raw material from these days? Mm. Because the objects in the museum collections were made from long straws with the corn on top. So that when it was cut, it didn't go through a threshing machine. It was the corn was knocked off it with flails, etc. So you had the straw as a byproduct of the corn, but the straw was long enough lengthwise to be able to plait it or coil it into either a chair or a mattress or a mat. That availability of straw material, the actual raw material of straw, isn't there anymore, because to increase the yield of corn, the straw has become quite small, quite short, and everything goes through threshing mills and stuff these days.
And how have they lasted so long? Things made out of straw from the 18th century, I mean, you'd think that they would go mouldy or something.
No, yeah, and that's kind of the point I was making at the beginning. So, yes, of course they did. The oldest objects we'd have in the museum are mid-19th century.
Okay.
But they were simply replaced if they needed to be.
Right.
And, of course, so many of the houses were damp, so that things would have become mouldy, would have disintegrated, but they could be replaced fairly easily. So you don't say, oh, this object is so many years old, 100 years old, 150 years old. It's the tradition of making it from the same material in the same fashion that is the important thing to look at, rather than the age of the actual object itself. Because a lot of the objects that were made in the, say, 1950s, 1960s, were made especially for the museum collection.
Okay. And how long would they be, the things that were made in the 1950s, how long would they be expected to last?
Oh, they would last. The oldest chair we have in the museum is an example from County Wexford in the southeast. It's a coiled wheaten straw chair, armchair, and that was made in 1840, and it's still intact.
Oh, my goodness, that's incredible. Yeah.
Now, you know, that particular chair was covered probably in a few layers of linen or cotton to protect it from damage and to protect maybe people from knocking into it and knocking the straws off, or people picking at the straw, or dogs clawing at it, or little children poking at the straw. So it had some form of material cotton fabric protection. But the chair itself has lasted from the 1840s in relatively perfect condition.
Because there's been a fashion that's sort of come and gone and come back again, I think, over the years of things made of wicker. Baskets and things like that. Yeah. So I'm surprised it's not still used as so much today for crafting and things.
I'm sure myself it's the availability of the raw material that's holding it back. And there is one particular group in Leitrim, a wonderful group, where they're giving out packets of oaten seed to people who have a bit of land, enticing them to try growing the oats and to have the oaten straw themselves for whatever purpose they need it. Because there are a lot of festivals during the year. There are festivals around St. Bridget's Day, which is the 1st of February, which I mentioned, and then at Christmas time, the mummer plays and the Renboy tradition, and people wear a straw costume at those events. So they might have a straw cape and a straw hat. And straw hat is in the form of a mask, comes conical shape, comes right down over the face to disguise the wearer. And people need the long straws for that. So those events are gaining in popularity. You know, they never quite died out, and now they're making a comeback, and people like to look at these traditions in their local area and see, oh, can we do that? You know, it's a fun event as well as looking at a traditional event and marrying the two. So they need the straws for that. So Edwina Gookian is this young woman's name in Leitrim, and she's encouraging people to try growing their own raw material.
Okay. And just quickly, I wanted to ask you, who was St. Bridget? What did she represent?
Well, St. Bridget, she's the... So let's say the human manifestation of and the Christian manifestation of the goddess Bridget. She was very important in terms of looking after the cattle, looking after milk, butter production. Very important saint in Ireland. In fact, this year, the government, in line with EU regulations, has given us an additional bank holiday. And the bank holiday is to be on St. Bridget's Day in recognition of the importance of St. Bridget alongside St. Patrick as one of the important patron saints of Ireland. Three patron saints. Patrick, people may not know, Patrick is only one of our patron saints. We also have St. Bridget, who was based in County Kildare in the east, and St. Cullum Kill in Donegal in the northwest. So we now have an additional bank holiday in honour of our saint, St. Bridget, St. Bridget.
Fabulous. Well, it's been a real eye-opener chatting with you today, Anne. Thank you so much for joining us, Anne O'Dowd. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Straw, Hay and Rushes in Irish Folk Tradition. It's available on our website. Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it. Cheers.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.